Friends, did you know that the temperature at night can have one of the biggest impacts on your sleep quality? If you often wake up too hot or too cold, I can definitely recommend Miracle Made's bed sheets. Inspired by NASA, Miracle Made uses silver-infused fabrics and makes temperature-regulating bedding so you can sleep at the perfect temperature all night long. In addition to their self-cooling properties for better quality sleep, Miracle Made bedding has awesome self-cleaning properties so you can say goodbye to stale odors. And you'll get the luxurious, super comfortable feel we're all looking for without the ridiculously high price tag. I have to be honest with you guys, I truly love my white Miracle Made sheets. They are so clean, they are so crisp, and they prevent up to 99.7% of bacterial growth. This leaves them to stay cleaner and fresher 3 times as long than other sheets. Most other sheets, they're teeming with little allergy and acne-causing bacteria that you do not want in your bed. So, why don't you just listen to me and go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code thestacks at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it is backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you are not 100% satisfied, you get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks and use the code thestacks to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode and making my bedtime even better. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and today we welcome to The Stacks award-winning author Lauren Markham. Lauren is here to talk about her new book, A Map of Future Ruins on Borders and Belonging. It follows the author's quest to trace her own Greek heritage, as well as recent immigration through Greece and a fire that destroyed Europe's largest refugee camp. This book about immigration quickly turns into a meditation on ancient history, mythology, and the predictive power of migration stories. Lauren is also the author of a book that I absolutely loved, The Far Away Brothers, Two Young Migrants and the Making of an American Life. Today, Lauren and I get to talk about myth-making, how immigration activism is tied to abolition, and the idea of a ghost book. Remember, the Stacks Book Club pick for February is Viral Justice, How We Grow the World We Want by Ruha Benjamin. I will be discussing this book on Wednesday, February 28th with Dr. Uche Blackstock. Quick reminder, everything we talk about on each episode of the Stacks can be found in the link in the show notes. If you like what you hear today, consider joining the Stacks Pack, which is our community for book lovers that you can find at patreon.com/thestacks. By joining the Stacks Pack, you make it possible for me to make this independent podcast every single week, and you get a slew of perks for yourself. Things like our monthly virtual book club, access to our Discord community, bonus episodes, shout outs on the show, and other awesome things. And it's only $5 a month. So please head to patreon.com/thestacks to join. Here's a shout out to our newest members, Rachel, Sunny Mumford, Carly, Shannon Sanders, Maricela Chavez, Bia Z, Meredith Edwards, Alyssa Munson, Jenny, and Alicia Ward. Thank you all so much. And thank you to the entire Stacks Pack. I could not make the show without you. All right, now it is time for my conversation with Lauren Markham. All right, everybody, I'm so excited. I am joined today by an author whose first book I read in 2018, sort of randomly. I don't even know how I found it. And I loved it. And I have been waiting sort of patiently for 6 years, maybe 5.5 years to get this next book. The book is called A Map of Future Ruins on Borders and Belonging. The author is Lauren Markham, and she is here. Lauren, welcome to the Stacks.
Thank you so much. I'm so honored to be here with you, Tracy.
I'm thrilled to have you. I hope at the end we'll have a little bit of time to talk about your first book, but I do want to talk about your new book, A Map of Future Ruins. In about 30 seconds or so, will you just tell folks what this book is about?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a book about migration and belonging, and it centers around the story of a fire that destroyed the largest refugee camp in Europe, which is a camp called Moria on the Greek island of Lesbos, and the six young Afghans that were fingered for that crime, in spite of, you know, very little evidence against them. So, but the book is sort of part reporting on contemporary borders and about that case, but it's also part memoir of my own family's migration story from Greece over a century ago. And it's an inquiry into the mythologies of Western civilization and of people on the move and of borders more broadly.
Yeah. I mean, we're going to talk about this because the book is working on a lot of different levels and I want to dig into sort of like your thinking as a writer. But yeah. I think my first question for you has to do with the Greece of it all. Your family's Greek. They, on your dad's side, they immigrated from Greece and you kind of go back and you find them and or find like where you're from and all of that. But I'm kind of curious, like at the bigger picture, because you're a journalist who writes about immigration. We should say that, like, that is your professional work. And so this book is sort of like your professional world and your personal world coming together. And the question, getting there, and the question is, what is it about Greece and immigration that maybe us North Americans who don't do this for work, maybe like don't understand or aren't thinking about? Like, why is this an interesting place to write what you've written?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. So exactly. I write a lot about immigration and borders. And for most of my career until about 2019, I was really focused on, I mean, I was writing about global immigration, but a lot of what I was writing about was immigration in the US context. So looking largely at our southern border and, you know, the cascade of borders south of our southern border that kind of lead up to our southern border here in the US. But I started reporting on Greece because I had a feeling, a hunch, a sort of like spidey sense that there was something that I was mostly dismissing at the time, but I was sort of like, well, let me just follow my notes here. That there was like some interesting symmetry between what was happening in the US and what was happening in Europe in terms of the very large number of people coming and the very massive efforts of the governments, in our case, the US government and in Europe, like many governments working, you know, together as the EU to keep people from crossing the border, mostly refugees and asylum seekers, out, you know, increasingly at any cost. So I saw the symmetry between, or possible symmetry between what was happening here and what was happening there. And I wanted to know more about that. But I also had this like interesting sense of like, this is this place that's a mythological place in my mind, because it's where my, you know, my family's origin story is narrated from, right? Like my family understands itself to be from this place that I'd never been. And we have this migration story from this place. And meanwhile, there are so many, I mean, you know, millions of people who are trying to get to Europe, who are crossing very, very perilous crossings, like they do in the United States, to get to Europe. And Greece is one of, because Greece is on the edge of Europe, Greece is kind of a gateway into the European Union. So that was sort of where I, that is why Greece and sort of where I started. It was also of note to me that Greece was this place where, that is so, you know, foundational, it's mythological standing, and it's the role of its mythologies, the mythologies that come from ancient Greece are really critical and key within the West's kind of, the so-called West's idea of itself. So I was kind of interested in all of those things, like this place where my family comes from. It's this place where all of these people are going. There are these symmetries to what's happening in the United States. And it's also this place that narrates itself as the origin of Western civilization, which in and of itself is a myth, right?
Right. And your book is very interested in myths and myth making about Greece and about immigration and about, like, I mean, America or established places to where immigrants want to go, and established is in giant air quotes there.
Yes.
But I guess the question around myth making for me, and the thing, like, as I was reading the book, you know, early in the book, you sort of talk about ancient Greece and like the Parthenon, which I have been to, like a good little tourist.
Yes.
Shout out to all the tourists out there. Yes. And you talk about how it wasn't always white. Like all of the ancient Greek stuff had paint and stuff on it. It was colors. And that really messed with my brain, because so much of America's visual mythology, if not also like
the idea of democracy and all of that is tied to these like great white pillars and yep. this certain kind of architecture that harkens back to a certain place and a certain time. And from the beginning, you know, you're sort of excavating, I guess, pun intended, what our country is founded on and like what it means mm-hmm. to be American and what it means to support democracy and all of these things. And I guess like, was that something that you, was the myth stuff something that you knew and understood as you were going in, or was that something that sort of revealed itself to you once you got in there and started like thinking about this project?
I would say both. Both are true. I was really interested, you know, most of the people coming to Greece, although not all, but many are coming via sea crossings. Mm-hmm. And that's true. Many people are coming into Europe via the sea. And, you know, one of the most famous texts that many of us were forced to read, probably a little bit too early, in my opinion, but in our lives, was like the Odyssey, right? There's yeah. this valiant hero traveling these seas, you know, and there's this sort of like, I mean, he's an historical figure, but it's also this mythology built around this historical figure, right, of his homecoming. And it's like, that's what he's trying to do. He's fleeing violence and experiencing all of these hardships, and he's trying to get to safety and home. And so I was sort of interested in this idea of like, well, this is the landscape of the Odyssey. This is the landscape of journeys and journey making and the mythological heroic journey. And when did the journey turn from like the territory of the hero into the territory of the wretch or the rejected or, you know, the misbegotten or the disenfranchised, right? And so I was sort of interested in that symmetry, although, you know, I knew that wasn't exactly enough to make a book out of. But right. again, in the sort of early stages, I was interested in that. But what revealed itself, the layers of mythology and myth-making kept revealing themselves to me over time, the more I researched this book. And everything from what you're talking about, like the mythology of whiteness, the myth of whiteness in ancient sculptures, right? This idea that like we see this classical and now neoclassical or contemporary classical images, and the way that's understood is this bare, white, lustrous stone. Well, that's, you know, that paint just flecked off, right? Like it was in fact, incredibly colorful. But there's also the myth of whiteness in general, like in terms of human whiteness, right? Like a lot of white supremacists today use the ancient world as a touchstone for their idea and ideals of white supremacy. But in fact, whiteness didn't exist as a concept. The great scholar Nell Irvin Painter writes beautifully about this, and I quote her in the book, you know, there was no idea of whiteness. There was no concept of whiteness in the ancient world. So that's something that's been created, right, in arrears. And that's what a myth is, right? It's a story we make backward. It's a story we tell backward to make sense of the present, right? And some myths are much more pernicious than others. So yeah, I would say that like I understood some, like there were some like interesting mythological things that were elements of this book that were calling me from the beginning, but more and more uncovered themselves and revealed themselves over time.
Right. I want to talk about what you sort of just touched on, also the idea that like coming to a new place by sea or like going somewhere in mm-hmm. certain myths is, you know, is a hero's journey and to be lauded and this great thing. And now we're in a time and place where people who leave their home to go to a new land to find a better world are criminalized, yep. villainized, dehumanized, all the bad-eyed diseases. But I want to know, I guess, just like from your research and knowledge, was there ever a time since the great myths of the world where immigrants and refugees were welcomed contemporaneously? Like we know mm-hmm. from American history and like from your family history in this book, like nobody liked the Greeks when they came. Nobody right. liked the Irish. Right. Nobody liked, you know, like
name it.
Yeah, anything. Anybody who's coming, we don't like yep. it. The Polish, mm-hmm. the Mexicans, yep. El Salvadorians, yep. like we hate you. Yep. Has there ever been a time where immigrants were welcomed warmly from jump for longer than like a few weeks by the locals? Because in your book, you do talk mm-hmm. about how some Greek people were very welcoming to the refugees, but that has yeah. quickly changed. So like, is there any time that it's been nice?
Yeah. So I would say to your sort of last point there, you know, one of the great tragedies of what's happened to refugees in contemporary Greece is that they were welcomed largely, you know, by and large, with open arms. And, you know, various people in Greece were nominated for the Nobel Prize in 2015 for what they were doing to welcome refugees to their shores. And since then, the situation has curdled for all sorts of reasons that we can talk about later. And there is a huge anti-immigrant, there's a huge, beautiful humanitarian solidarity movement, but there's a massive anti-immigrant upswell there. But to your question about, you know, throughout human history, I mean, I think there are times and places and sort of cultures past and present and far past and present and in the middle where refugees have been more welcomed. But ancient Greece is actually a place that we can look. The writer John Washington, who has a new book coming out soon about A Case for Open Borders, he's a fantastic immigration journalist, and he writes beautifully about how, you know, asylum in ancient Greece was not just a political practice, but almost a spiritual idea. The idea that we must, you know, asulia means, it means protected by the gods. That's where asylum comes from. So one could come, there was a ritual where one would come in and come into the city state and go to a particular place and wrap a branch around their arm. Then that was, you know, their application for asylum. It was sort of like an application and a supplication and saying, you know, I need protection, I need to be here. And that was a pretty time-honored practice. So it's interesting that, you know, this place that so many, you know, again, scare quotes here, but, you know, Western countries look to as the birthplace of civilization itself, and certainly of Western civilization. And these now Western countries are doing so much to try to keep refugees out, are actually forgetting this fundamental idea and ideal of ancient Greece and of democracy, which is that we want to protect our neighbors when they need protection, and we want to offer this practice.
Okay, well, you teased this earlier. You said for many reasons, things have changed in Greece and the people who are welcoming folks with open arms. You said, we'll get to that later. Well, let's just get to it now. What happened? Like, what the fuck?
Yeah. I mean, I think a couple of things. One is that people were out there welcome, right? And situations were out there welcome. So, you know, truly grandmothers in Greece were walking down to the shore, baking cookies and handing, you know, like, and baking bread and giving what little they had to the refugees who were landing. Tons of Greeks and people from all over Europe came to, you know, especially islands like Lesbos and Chios and Samos, the hotspot islands on, you know, which are kind of closest to Turkey. So where many of the boats land because of their geographic proximity to the border. And, you know, fishermen were halting their fishing operations and going out and truly like lifting people from the sea and saving them. And over time, resources become drained. That is, you know, a fisherman has to go back and fish. And there is a sense that, you know, like, okay, where is the help from outside? It's one thing, an emergency. When something is happening for a couple of months, for a year, we can call it an emergency. I think when the same circumstance continues over years and years and years, which it has basically since 2015, with, you know, some ebbing and flowing, that ceases to feel to the people living there like an emergency, and it feels like an abandonment to a lot of people. They feel like, okay, where is Germany here? Where are other, you know, more resource countries in the EU coming to help us? Why is it that we are shouldering the work of caring for these people and managing this emergency, right? So I think there's that. But also, like in the United States and like in countries all over, you know, the world, immigrants and refugees have been used as a political football and a rallying cry for right-wing populism, right? Mm-hmm. To say, vote for us because look at what's happening here. Look at all of these people. They're not desperate refugees coming here. They're people coming to steal your jobs and your livelihoods and to take your homes. And these are invaders, right? So the profile of the refugee all over the world has been cast as an invader. And Greece, you know, right-wing leaders in Greece have capitalized upon that and won. And then I would also say that it's important to remember and hold the context of the 2008 debt crisis and what that did mm-hmm. to Greece. I mean, Greece is still reeling from the effects of the 2008 debt crisis, that effectively the powers of Europe hitched Greece to an endless debt regime. right? So it's one of the poorest countries in Europe. So you have people sort of saying like, well, wait a second, we have Angela Merkel, we have the Germans, and the Dutch, you know, like all these countries in Europe that sort of created this crisis for us and make us one of the poorest countries in Europe. They are telling us what we have to do with the refugees for Europe. And sure, they're sending money here, but they decide how many refugees they take and when they take them and who gets asylum and who doesn't. We're, you know, an island, like the island of Lesbos is 90,000 people who live there. And right, and you know, there have been 20,000, 30,000 refugees on the island at any one given time at certain points. Like that does not feel to people living on Lesbos like an equitable shouldering of the care for refugees. So I think like some people are just furious at Europe for not, at the rest of Europe for not helping more. And I would also say that there are other other people who are angry at the refugees themselves for them coming at all.
Right. One of the things that I have become obsessed with in the years that I've been doing this podcast is abolition. Mm-hmm. It started as an interest in police and prison abolition. Mm-hmm. Since I have been reading in those spaces, I've realized it's actually like a lot of other things, including especially immigration and borders and these detention centers and all of this stuff. And you don't spend a ton of time on it in the book because it's really not the point of your book. But towards the end, you do sort of talk about like what can be done or what could be done differently. You mentioned that like detentions are $134 a day per person, but other models, which are like a case management model, cost only $4 a day per person. And I guess the bigger question for me as I think about, because one of the things that I love about abolition and the thinking is like, what is possible? Like, how am I limiting myself to thinking within these systems that are already broken? And what can we do that's bigger or better? And so my question for you, and I don't know if there's an answer, but like, do we need borders?
I don't think we need, I certainly think we do not need borders in the way that we have them, right? And I think that we do not need militarized borders that are such wicked, terrible lines in the sand, right? That are fortified and treated as absolutes, right? When they're actually figments of the political and social imagination. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, I'll plug, I have not read it, but I really admire his writing. I'll plug John Washington's forthcoming book, which is, you know, A Case Against Borders, because that's like the project of that book.
Right.
But what I will say is that the border has become a political tool and a symbol, but a very like real symbol to send the very message I was just talking about with that, like the politicians are sending to the Greeks. And again, this, you know, has echoes everywhere, including very, very, very to any US American listener, right? Like we have heard this story. We hear this all the time. We're hearing it right now with Abbott in Texas, right? Like, and you know, with Florida and every, you know, all sorts of political rhetoric of we must seal our borders. If we don't, they are coming for us. If we don't, this horrific thing will happen. And it creates a boogeyman out of anyone on the other side of the border. It creates an othering, and that is an incredibly effective political tool. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I've been writing and thinking about, and I write about it a little bit in the book, and I've been writing about it since, is the way that not only are immigrants othered and turned into sort of rendered as criminals, as invaders, marauding invaders, right? These characters of malicious intent coming for you. Like it really is sort of like, they're like, you know, the zombie apocalypse is not like a totally unfair like corollary here, right? Like there are these like scary, terrifying people on the other side coming for us. And that is why we must do everything to protect the border. So we criminalize immigrants. And that's exactly what happened to the six Afghans I write about in this case, that it's like, okay, we, you know, this place burned down, someone needs to pay for it. These six will do. So we criminalize immigrants and we decide that they can be, I mean, to your point about abolition, we decide that they must be housed in prisons, right? That's what detention is. It's a prison. So we're going to, the immigrants come across, we're going to put them in prison, even if they are fighting for a case to stay and they have a case, you know, moving through courts, they can still be staying in prison. But we also are increasingly criminalizing the people helping them, right? And so the border is not only an effective tool in, and the sort of fortification of the border and the mythology of the border is not only an effective tool in stripping rights and humanity of people immigrating, but it's also a wildly effective tool to get citizens and people living on this side of the border, right, inside the border, to give up and cede their rights. And that is the major autocratic project, right? Mm. That we will all cede rights in because the border and protecting it is so important. And we see that happening all the time.
Right.
And we see it happening increasingly. And that is like, you know, that's what Stephen Miller has sort of laid out in, right. in Trump's immigration plan.
Right. And it should be said, I mean, you said it in the book very clearly, but for folks at home, like, it's not illegal to come to a country
right.
and seek asylum. Like, that yep. is fully legal. So the idea that people are being imprisoned for that behavior, and by behavior, I mean doing a thing to save yes. their lives and their families. I shouldn't say behavior because yes. behavior sounds like naughty. Yeah. I've been around too many four-year-olds, I guess. But that people are being criminalized for doing something that has been, you know, globally agreed on is within their human rights. That's yep. the part that's like extra super duper fucked up. Because yep. at least like when you are criminalizing people for committing crimes, there's some argument that if you believe in punishment, then they are deserving of punishment because they've committed a crime. But in this yes. case, you're punishing people for doing something that is allegedly within their human rights, which makes yeah. it like extra super duper fucked.
It's within their rights under international law and U.S. domestic law, right?
Right, like, right.
It's
part of our myth, right? Yes. Part of the American mm-hmm. myth yes. is this great mixing, melting mm-hmm. pot. We have all these cultures. America's great because we're a country of immigrants. Like all of our national mythology mm-hmm. or a huge part of it is around this idea of send us your weary or whatever yeah. the fuck yeah. Lady Liberty. I don't know. I'm not into the myths, but like it's, yeah. you can't, it's like almost impossible to square all of that with what's actually happening unless yes. you're like, well, America's full of shit, which some of us are okay saying that. But if you're not like, yeah. It's yeah. hard.
Well, I think that's you're hitting on exactly what sort of the initial compulsion to write this book and it continued preoccupation as I was writing it, which is this idea that my family sort of holds, and a lot of white U.S. American families of like the Ellis Island era hold onto and get to sort of hold this valiant story of, you know, someone came here and sacrificed and because of the opportunities they were afforded and their bootstrappy hard work, we get to be who we are, mm-hmm. right? And we get to have our life thanks to them and thanks to this, you know, so-called American dream. And that is, frankly, like a wildly sanitized story. Mm-hmm. Like, again, a mythology, something we've created, you know, in retrospect. That's a story we've told backwards, right? To make sense of the present and to make the present meaningful, we've told a story backward. Because the fact is, there are lots of scholars who write really beautifully about this. We sort of sanitized the Ellis Island experience, mm-hmm. you know? It was actually like really awful and really horrible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as I sort of write and ruminate about in the book, my great-grandmother had four kids, and two of them, you know, one was my grandmother, and one was my Uncle Nikki, and the other two died really tragic early deaths. So this story, even just like within my own family, this story of like, everything's great, worked out great for us because of the American dream, like, it's not true. It's actually like 50% of, you know, my immigrant grandmother's children, great-grandmother's children, you know, had very tragic lives. And, you know, one of the other preoccupations that the book was holding was like, so my family gets to have sort of that story and gets to tell the story backward. And yet contemporary immigrants are relegated to the space of the criminal and the invader and the, you know, the person crossing that line. So we have this wild double standard among white U.S. Americans who kind of hold dear to the story of where they came from, while also either tacitly or actively supporting the exclusion of contemporary immigrants.
Yeah. Okay, wait, let's take a quick break and we'll be right back. When I started podcasting, an online store was truly the furthest thing from my mind. Now I'm selling super cute sweatshirts, tote bags, other bookish swag, and it's so easy. All because I use Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit $1 million order stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, they have you covered. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system for wherever or whatever you're selling. If you came to the Stacks tour and bought merch, that was the in-person POS system. I'm just telling you, I use it. I love it. Turn your casual browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. It is 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. In case you don't know, I was an emotional mess when I first saw the Stacks merchandise on a listener while out in public. After starting this podcast and building a community, I had to be talked into creating merchandise, and Shopify made it possible. There is a 0% chance I would have merch if Shopify wasn't so easy to use. Did you know Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States? Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/thestacks, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/thestacks now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/thestacks. Okay, y'all, this past week, I threw a party in LA to celebrate the LA Times Book Festival and just generally bookish people all around. And it was the best time. I'm sure you've seen the pictures on Instagram, but I have to say a huge thank you to Lit Cocktails for helping make this party a total blast. Lit Cocktails is a mobile bartending company that provides a fun, personable, unique, yet professional experience for clients who want more than your average boring black tie bartenders. They're here for weddings, birthday parties, corporate events, or any other reason you might need to celebrate with a cocktail. Lit Cocktails is owned and operated by Diamond Davis, a Black LGBTQ woman who started the company after losing her job as a restaurant manager during the 2020 pandemic. Diamond has created more than just a service. It is truly an experience, and it celebrates diversity, love, and community. I could feel that from the bar the entire evening. Diamond was a joy to have. She made the best drinks, always had a smile on her face, and honestly became one of my new favorite people. Lit Cocktail packages include ice, garnishes, cups, napkins, straws, a customized menu, two specialty cocktails, non-alcoholic beverages and mixers, one free hour of setup and breakdown, and an alcohol shopping list. Literally, you don't need to do anything but hire Diamond. She takes care of the rest. They also offer tastings for an additional fee, where they customize 8 to 10 drinks based on your flavor profile, and they'll even bring them to your home for you to sample. Go book a free consultation today by visiting www.litcocktailsllc.com or send a DM to @litcocktails on Instagram. Again, that's litcocktailsllc.com or send a DM to @litcocktails on Instagram.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, we're back. I want to talk about the Moria Six, and because that's a huge part of your book, in addition to the myth making and all of that, which is a group. Well, it's six individual Afghan young men. Some of them were minors. Some of them were adults. Some of them were both, according to the Greek and the Afghans, who were convicted of setting this fire that burns down this Moria refugee camp, which is this huge camp on Lesbos in Greece. And the camp was you know, from my understanding, feels a lot like the southern border and maybe Arizona or Texas, which is just like one of the most politically toxic places when it comes to the border. And just like it's where all the conversations are being had about what's going on and what's wrong and what's right, et cetera. And so this fire happens. These six young people are convicted. They're blamed. They're criminalized. And I don't know. There's not really a question, but I want to talk about it because it feels bad. It feels really bad.
Yep. It was. Yes. There are so many threads there. And I think that so effectively what the fascinating thing to me about Moria was that it was this camp and it was widely known as Human Rights Graveyard. And not only is it widely known as that, there's a huge to this day and it's like a burned down, you know, ruin. But to this day on the concrete wall outside of it, it says, "Welcome to Europe, Human Rights Graveyard," you know, on it, and this massive graffiti. So it was widely known as this human rights graveyard. But no one on the left wanted it. None of the refugees wanted it because it was such an awful place. I mean, it was truly a place of like misery and squalor. It was completely neglected and completely abandoned. And it, you know, many people, I talked to a guy who worked at the UN and he was sort of like a career United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, like worker, you know, he'd worked all over the world. He'd worked in some of the worst, you know, the most difficult, like worst supported refugee camps in the world. And he was like, "This is honestly one of the hardest because this is Europe and this should be better. It shouldn't be like this." You know what I mean? So it was this place of neglect and it was this potent symbol for how refugees were being met and treated in Europe and the way that they were sort of relegated and kept on these hotspot islands in Greece because the rest of Europe wouldn't take them, right? Until they went through a process that could take years. And so there was this group of people that were growing and growing and growing and had very few resources. But the right hated it too, right? The right hated it because they're like, "Get these people out of here. Like, we don't want these people on our island. Like, get these people out of here." And the left and, you know, refugee solidarity people were like, "Get these people out of here because this is a human rights graveyard and this is awful and these camps shouldn't exist in the first place." I will say, and this is to like an earlier point, that a really interesting thing happened for me. You were sort of talking about the way, when you were talking about abolition, this notion of like the way we sort of sometimes make presumptions about the way things have to be because we are institutionalized in a way, like in our minds, right? Like we are stuck sometimes in our imaginations because the structures around us, it's sometimes when the structures are so heavy and oppressive, it's sometimes hard to see outside of them, right? I think that you're so right about that with abolition. And that was fascinating for me to see because the thing about Moria was that it was an awful place. You know, we're talking rats like biting kids' faces, you know, it was infested with rats. Like 500 people for a single toilet, everyone living in tents. It would snow some years and people were just living in tents with no, you know, with no heat. Then they'd put, you know, little heaters or like cook stoves to warm and then a fire would break out. You know, it was just awful. But they could leave, right? They could actually take the bus into town or walk to the beach and they could leave and then come back, right? Like they could, it was an open air prison, but they could leave the open air prison. And I remember being in Greece at first being like, yeah, this is really bad, but like at least they can leave, right? Because, you know, in the United States, like they can't leave. And that spoke to me about just how, like, I've been writing about immigration and, you know, I wrote an op-ed called like the cruelty of the US immigration system, like calling for it to be dismantled. And yet I was still institutionalized in my mind into the like, well, at least they can leave. That's good, right? You know what I mean? Because like the normal for me is that refugees are locked up, even though I know how awful and abnormal and how that needs to end, right? So that's one of the things that called me to writing about Greece because, and to writing about an immigration context and deeply researching an immigration context outside of the US, which is that like, I feel like after my last book, like I'm like, I have said what I have to say and I'm saying it again and again and again and I'm feeling stuck. I'm feeling like looping, like I'm feeling like I'm a little bit losing my mind because I'm just looping again and again. And it was really helpful to like go somewhere else and learn about what's happening there and be able to see these symmetries and be able to see the way my mind works and the places that the grooves that I had gotten stuck in and the grooves that we've all gotten stuck in, right? So anyway, Moria was instructive to me. So Moria in September of 2020, a massive fire broke out and it quickly, you know, over the course of 2 days, basically incinerated the entire place, like, you know, to dust. There were about 11,000 people living there at the time. It was built, by the way, for 3,500. And those people were all set on the run. They were on the streets for weeks. You know, when they tried to revolt and say, get us off the streets, there's not enough food. Or, so, you know, we're all like defecating in the streets. Like there's not enough sanitary. Like we have no housing. We're just in the streets after being displaced again, after being refugees, you know, being displaced here. And there were the police tear gassed them. It was just a complete emergency and failure on the part of the Greek government to do the right thing. But what they needed was fall people, right? It was like, this place burned down. We think it's arson. These guys will do. And, you know, I am the daughter of two criminal defense lawyers. I know that it is unlikely that we'll ever know for sure exactly what happened at the Moria fire. But I can tell you that there is absolutely no evidence that these young people, these six young people, started the fire. Mm-hmm. And in fact, an incredible kind of like digital research firm called Forensic Architecture did a remarkable report on the fire and showed, you know, mapped the fire with the winds, with the drought. And it showed that like, it was probably honestly an effect, the effect of drought and climate change and just like a really, really, really hot summer with not a lot of water and massive overcrowding that caused this, you know, this fire to just leap and spread incredibly quickly. So it probably wasn't even arson at all. In any case, the Greek government needed a fall guy, right? This horrible thing had happened. These six kids were fingered for the crime with very little evidence, and they've been in prison ever since September 2020.
You just mentioned something about yourself when you were talking about like, oh, at least they can leave. And it kind of hadn't like hit for you how like maybe desensitized or like how entrenched you were after having seen so many things. And you talk about how even these like immigration court judges, like they are suffering from vicarious trauma and that there's just like so much trauma from obviously first and foremost, the people who are leaving their homes, fleeing, you know, going, crossing perilous waters or, you know, blistering deserts or whatever it is, mountains, whatever it is to get to safety and to find a place where they can, you know, survive, but also that has a huge trickle down effect and that it's affecting the entire sort of immigration complex. And I'm wondering if you feel like as a person who's witnessing this, if we're focusing enough on the trauma or are we focusing too much on it? Or, you know, like I just am really curious because as a person who's not there, who doesn't see it firsthand, I have my own opinions, but in reading your book, maybe they've changed. So I'm curious what you think about that.
That's such a fascinating question. I mean, you know, I worked at a high school for many years where I like coordinate for immigrant youth in Oakland, and I coordinated mental health services. And so my like, you know, there's a part of me that's like, we never are focused enough on trauma and serving people who have been traumatized by these systems. But I will also say that trauma is an effect, right? Mm-hmm. And the effect of experiences and, you know, the effects of trauma follow an experience. And so much of the trauma related to immigration once the border is crossed have to do with the systems themselves and even beforehand, right? And so I think, yes, of course we must be focusing on the trauma. And I think that this question you're raising, I mean, as you know from reading the book, that this question of vicarious trauma and how numb many of us can become to really horrific conditions experienced by others, like almost sometimes as a coping mechanism, right? Mm-hmm. Like the numbness that serves us, right? Because it helps us not feel very difficult things, which then is very adversely impacts solidarity efforts, right? And fighting for justice and what's right. But for the people who have experienced trauma themselves, I mean, I would say absolutely we need to be focusing on the effects of that. Like, what is the effect for these six young Afghans of having left their homes in Afghanistan, largely because of the U.S. intervention in Afghanistan, right, that has been going on for decades? They leave Afghanistan, they come to Greece, they're stuck for over a year in this horrific refugee camp, then it burns down, then they get fingered for the crime, and even though they can prove that they're children, they still get tried as adults. Like, they were not in the place where the fire started. doesn't matter. They have a 2-day trial. They get put in jail. And, you know, as one of them told me relatively recently, actually, who's like, if I ever get out of prison, I have to get out of Greece immediately. Like, this place has broken my heart. That's what he said to me. This place has broken my heart, you know, like, and so the trauma that these young men have experienced is remarkable. But I think we want to focus not just on the trauma, but on the systems that caused it, right? Or that exacerbated it or perpetuated. And I think we sort of have to be holding both of those things simultaneously, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I guess, like, to this point of, like, holding both of these truths and, like, seeing refugees and immigrants as full realized human beings and not just people who have experienced trauma or people who are, like, whatever, you know, living through hell, that, and you call this out in the book, you say that, like, immigration stories, like, both the writer and the reader are sort of cast as saviors and, like, we focus on a lot of the people around the actual immigrants when we tell these stories, like the grandmothers who bring the cookies or the crane operator guy or the nice judge or whatever that looks like.
Yep.
And I'm wondering, like, how can we tell better stories? Because so much of this book is about how we tell stories. How can we tell better stories that are holistic around people as individuals, and they don't become huddled masses or whatever it says on the Statue of Liberty? I don't know. It says
She'd
be saying things, Lady Liberty.
Totally.
But, like, how, because part of what is so crushing about what's going on is the sheer numbers of people, but also every people is a person, right? Like, so I don't know. How do we remove our own savior complexes from these stories, both from as readers and writers?
Yeah, such beautiful questions. You're such an amazing reader. I'm like, oh my gosh, she really read this book. Like,
I did
so
read
honored.
It.
I mean, I don't mean, like, did you actually do your homework? I meant, like, you're just such a brilliant reader, an insightful reader. It means so much. The ideal reader. That's absolutely, you know, I actually was relatively late in this book writing process. I'm like, oh, this is a book about storytelling and how we tell stories, you know? and the thing you're saying about numbers, this is the paradox of writing, I think, about any social issue and you know, particularly migration, which is, you know, what I write a lot about, which is that the numbers and the scale is incredibly important. Mm-hmm. And yet an overfocus on scale can obscure detail and individuality and nuance, right? And so it's like the journalist's job is to make meaning of scale, but how do you make meaning of scale without blurring the contours of what you're writing about? And, you know, I talk about this all the time with my writing students. Part of the issue is, like, the sort of journalistic trope is, I'm going to write about the crisis of unhoused people in San Francisco. So I'm going to find one person that I'm going to follow,
right,
to make meaning of that and to, like, so that people can see what it's like to be an unhoused person in San Francisco. And again, I've written a story, you know, many stories like this. But the problem with that is that, like, on the one hand, you are giving someone space on the page to be an individual. But on the other hand, you're making that person carry an entire sociopolitical dynamic on their shoulders and that's just, like, that's a little bit of the trap. And so I feel like I'm not answering your question, but I'm mostly saying, yes, this is such an important question. One of the things when it comes to immigration stories that I'm particularly preoccupied with is, we so often start immigration stories at the point of immigration when actually, like, even the decision to migrate starts way, 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 way before the person gets to the border, right? Like, and the conditions that caused that person to migrate started way, way, way before they decided to migrate or even imagine migrating, and maybe even before they were born, right? So it's like, so it's kind of like there's, like, a scope that I'm interested in. Like, how do we hold a breadth and scope and sort of understanding of causality? Like, what were the conditions working upon this individual?
Right. Did you, he blurbed your book, but have you read Jonathan Blitzer's new one, Everyone Who's Gone Is Here?
So fantastic. Yeah.
I'm, like, I'm reading it, but I was reading it while I was reading your book, and I was fuck, I gotta stop. I don't know. I don't know how it happened. I think I was like reading his on audio, and then anyways.
Yeah.
But he does a great job in that book of going back really far.
Exactly.
To tell his subject stories to the point where as I'm like 30% into the book, and I was like, wait, is this guy going to the United States? Like what? Like right. I'm like legitimately like, yes. wait, I've been with this guy for 30 years already. And like, we're not even in like,
totally.
He's just like hanging out in Mexico for decades. So I think he does a really great job of that. And I that was something that stuck out to me, like kind of reading your books together. But then I had to pause because I was like, I'm starting to like blur, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Of course. No, I mean, that's like such a valiant project of his book, is sort of showing all of the causalities that kind of played out and all of the ways various elements of geopolitical decisions played out upon places in Central America, the countries in Central America that are now, you know, have these like mass exoduses, because we can't look at any one historical moment, even if that moment is now, in any kind of vacuum, right?
Right.
I would also say to your question of sort of like, you know, how do we tell better stories is, and this can sort of be tropey, but it's like, how do we allow the people to be more than just the experience? How do we as storytellers make space for people to be people and exist beyond the bounds of the sociopolitical dynamic we are writing about? Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And that's been really, really important to me. I mean, I will say, like, with my first book, which is The Faraway Brothers, I write about these identical twin brothers. I know you have twins. Yes,
have identical twin brothers.
Yeah, I know. what was so fascinating about them to me was so many things, but it was, they had really different experiences of their own immigration stories, and you kind of couldn't find two people who were more the same. You know, they were raised by the same people. They look exactly alike. Like, they'd spent almost all of their waking and sleeping hours, like, you know, in very close proximity to each other. And yet they experienced the same events differently, like internally. So yeah, I mean, I don't have a great answer except for like a real attempt to hold that question at the red hot center of everything we're writing.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that's right. I mean, that kind of question that I ask is usually not just for you and for me, but also for people listening, like to think about it a little bit, because there isn't really a good answer. And I'm sure if I asked every person who's ever written a thing about a person who's ever immigrated, they'd have a different answer. Or if I asked every person who's ever immigrated, you know, like that.
Totally.
But that is something that deserves our attention, like as we try to like read and engage with what's going on.
Yeah.
And speaking of reading, one of my, as you said before so kindly, I'm the ideal reader, which I appreciate.
You are.
But I love it. But one of the things I love reading is the acknowledgments of a book, and yours are fantastic.
Aww.
And I have two questions about your acknowledgments. One is, you mention Maggie Nelson's idea of a ghost book.
Yes.
Can you explain what that is? I've never heard that before, and I'd love to know a little bit more.
Yes, the ghost text. Actually, one of my, a student who's like an incredible novelist, who was in one of my classes that I taught, brought this notion to my attention. I was like, oh, yes. So Maggie Nelson said that a lot of her books have a kind of ghost book, and, you know, a book that secretly, or not so secretly as the case may be, stands behind my book, not just as its muse, but often as its literal stylistic and or structural model. So it's this idea that like there's a book that your book is in either direct conversation with on the page, or maybe even just like it is, you're in constant conversation in your mind with it as you're writing. And so mine, I was so taken with that because I was like, wait, I have one of those. I know exactly what she's talking about. You know what I mean? It like hit me with I recognized what she was talking about, because mine is a book by Svetlana Boym called The Future of Nostalgia, which is just a remarkable book where she's looking at this notion of nostalgia and has kind of an interesting framework for thinking about nostalgia. And she has two different kind of categories of nostalgia. One is more like sort of emotional and self-conscious and sort of thinks longingly toward the past, but with an understanding that There's a distance between past and present, and there's some, you know, there's a longing for a past and maybe a recognition that it might not exist in the way that we long for it. And then there's something called restorative nostalgia, which is the much more the kind of nostalgia we see in like white supremacist movements and nationalistic mm-hmm. movements of this kind of like, you know, make America great again. Like there is this past moment, this past time, this past era that we must return to. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, that past never is real. That past never right. exists. But it's a mythological past. And she writes about the way nostalgia plays out over the way cities are designed. And she's just like a brilliant theorist. And I just read that book again and again and again. And it helped sharpen my thinking. It helped mm-hmm. expand my thinking. It was also suggested to me, actually on stage, by the writer Sasha Hamon, Alexander Hamon. And he was talking about this book, and I was like, I must go read it. And I read an excerpt that very night, and then immediately, you know, got my hands on the book. So I owe a lot to Sasha Hamon for bringing my ghost text to my attention.
I just love that so much. I love the idea of a ghost book or ghost yeah. text, because one of the questions I always ask people is, what's a book that, like, what's something that you would recommend or like that your work is in conversation with? And a lot of times when I ask that question, people answer, but sometimes people are like, they have no idea. And that is very hard for me to fathom, because there's so many times when I'm reading a book and I'm like, this is in conversation with this thing.
Totally.
And sometimes I'm like, okay, maybe they've never read it. But sometimes I'm like, I know you've read this. Like, I know yes. you, this is in your brain somewhere. And like, maybe you're not thinking of it in that way, but like, I am seeing the parallels.
Totally.
the yep. other thing you say in your acknowledgments is that this book, A Map of Future Ruins, owes everything to your life as a reader. And I yeah. want you to say more about that.
Yeah. I mean, it's connected to exactly what you just said. You know, I took a picture of this like a mass stack of books that influenced this book and that helped me both learn specific things, fill holes. I talk about this with students, this notion of like, as a writer, there are holes you have when you're approaching a project. And I think this is true of fiction, what little I write of fiction, I'm hoping to write more. And it's certainly true in nonfiction. Like, I didn't know that much about the Greek debt crisis, for instance, you know what I mean? Like, but then there are hungers. Like, I just wanted to learn more about the Oracle. Like, maybe there was something mm-hmm. there. I just wanted to learn more about that. So I read an excellent book called The Oracle by William Broad, a New York Times reporter, which was like super fantastic. And so like, there was this stack of books that were attending to both my holes and my hungers. And there was sort of like, these are things I need to learn in order to like, be able to write this book, to understand the things that people are telling me, but also to like further attend to my hungers and just these things that I'm kind of interested in learning and these rabbit holes I want to follow to see, you know, what's there. But it's also true that this book is a little bit more discursive than my first book. It's much more of a weaving together of ideas mm-hmm. and storylines mm-hmm. and it was a little bit terrifying to do that because mm-hmm. it's just harder structurally to do. And it took a little bit of courage to deviate from like what I had done before and to kind of take that leap into like, maybe these things go together. I feel like they do in my heart. Can I convince other people that this holds together? Mm-hmm. And I think the only way I could amass that courage is by reading, you know, and just reading yeah. books. So, yeah.
Well, I don't have to ask you the question of what books you would recommend that are in conversation with your work, because you've already given us some. so we'll just pretend like I asked, but it's on the record. But I do have to ask you about how you write. Where yeah. are you? How many hours a day? How often? Snacks and beverages. You do mention in the book that you drink tea.
I do.
Which I clocked because I am a tea girly. So I need to know about how you drink your tea, what kind of tea you drink, if you drink it while you write. I know Amazing. You mentioned being in the backyard writing. So just yes. set the scene for us.
Yes, absolutely. I love this question. So I recently just moved, so my setup is different and a little okay. bit more chaotic. But my partner and I lived in a 600 square foot house until very recently, and we also have a kid and a cat. And we had a tiny little backyard in Berkeley. So we, blessedly, right before the pandemic, we built a little hut in the backyard, and that's where I wrote. And it was this beautiful. I actually had a dream once that I was like, I had this like really kind of incredible expand, like one of those dreams that you're like, something else was going on. There was sort of like, I was accessing some like higher insight. And I had this dream that I like had this office within a redwood, and that's where I was like creating all of, I was a painter for some reason in this dream. But in fact, this little like, this little office that we built was this magical little cabin, super tiny, you know, like, you know, maybe like 60 square feet that was made of these, this like salvaged redwood that we found. So it was this beautiful space that our friend Dylan built for me. And I wrote this book almost entirely there during the pandemic. I have to write with tea. I'm a black tea drinker.
Straight up or milk and sugar?
You know, it's a, rarely sugar, sometimes milk, like my Earl Grey tea. I kind of like have to do, I wake up in the morning, I'm like, which tea is it today?
Yes,
so Earl Grey tea, are you? Okay, yes. I want to hear what other teas. Earl Grey tea always wants milk, but I've actually been drinking this tea that I got in Greece that has this mass, it's black tea, but it has this, it's called mastika or mastic gum. It's like a sort of like a bay leafy minty kind of deal that's infused into the tea. It's really good. And that wants no milk. And I will say, I wish that I was like a more ritualized writer in the sense that like, I wish that I was like, I wake up and then I do this and these are my best times of day. But I have to say my writing is like a bit catch as catch can. You know, I have a couple of other jobs. I have a kid. I have, you know, and so I'm trying to sort of like carve out particular times. I am trying to write a novel and I'm trying to be like every Friday morning, that's what I do for an hour just to like see what comes out of that. But I have to say when I find time is when I write and I try to carve that time out, but it's not necessarily ritualized.
Right. Yeah. Do you do snacks?
Totally. Dark chocolate. I have dark. Okay. Yeah. That's my main snack and my main like
I'll
treat.
I'll allow that. I find dark chocolate to be kind of disgusting.
Really? Even though you're a black tea drinker.
Yes, but I put milk and sugar in my tea and my tea comes out very cloudy.
I love it.
It's kind of like a tinted milk, I think is what it is.
Are you like an Earl
black
Grey?
Tea, black. Earl Grey, English breakfast. Yep. Yep. But I will sometimes drink like a chai from a tea bag, not like a concentrate latte. But there, I've gotten like embarrassingly snobby about my tea. I used to just be like, I used to drink like whatever they had at Starbucks and be like, this is great. Now I went to Starbucks a few weeks ago and got tea and was like, I can't drink this garbage. And I was like, I have gone too far. Like when I have friends who travel, if they're going to like Europe or Canada,
like,
I'll have them bring me back
tea.
Yes. My mom was in London. She bought me back this like black rose from Fortnum and Mason that is like the best tea ever. And I ration it out. Another friend was in London and bought me this black tea from Sketch, the high tea place. It's so good.
What was the rose tea? Because Rebecca Solnit got me this, like, it truly came in a treasure box. It was like it called Akbar, I think, this rose tea. And I just finished it and I need to like find it again.
Okay. I will send you my two rose teas because I have a Parisian rose tea and then a British rose tea.
Oh my gosh. I need to know. And next time I'm curious if you like this mastic tea. So I'll get you some next time I go back.
Literally anybody who drinks tea on the show, I end up having a full, like
sending
Jasmine Ward. Like box of teas, like a sampler of my favorite teas.
She's a tea girly too.
She likes a black tea also. Oh, yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. So yep, there's few of us because it's a lot of like green tea or like herbal tea, and I'm not interested in those people.
Nope. No,
but
thank
the black
you.
Tea drinkers,
we are.
We're a
crew.
We're a family.
Stick together.
Yes. It's you, me, and Jasmine right now. And also, I think Crystal Hana Kim drinks black
I love her.
Tea.
Oh, that's really good to know.
I used to be like her and reuse the tea in the tea bag over and over, but now I need a stronger concentrate for all my milk.
Same. I kind of like the second brew. It's just not doesn't do it for me. No,
me neither. I've started just being really just splurging and just a fresh tea bag. Yep. I just need a fresh tea bag.
Totally. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. The tea fam.
Yes. Me too. I'm so glad to have this. When I saw it in the book, I was like, page 249, like make a note. Okay, another thing that I'm passionate about is being a terrible speller. So what is a word that you can never spell correctly on the first try.
Oh my God, no words.
Are you a terrible speller as well?
Oh my God, I'm a terrible speller. Especially, I have a problem with double. I put double T's or double M's or like they don't exist. So like commitment.
Yes, commitment, yeah, right? Committee. How about the E's on committee? I don't know. Maybe there's
that,
five
that's easier for me because it's so weird that I'm just like, I know they got two at the end, at the end, but I don't know the other ones. Like the double T's and the double M's and the, like I can't, I mean, I'm truly a terrible speller.
Oh, good, me too.
Towel, does it have two L's? I don't know. I don't think so, but I think it might. Yeah. Like I could see it either way. It's like, I don't see it. I don't see the word.
I'm with you. I can't see it. Yep. And I learn it, I can't retain it. Recommendation.
Completely.
Like a month or two ago, I spelled recommendation correctly on the first try. And I was like, what did I do? Job. What did I do? Haven't done it since.
But then it's like everything's got spell check. Yeah. So it's like, I don't have to learn at this point. I'm 40. You know what I mean?
Well, I've recently started taking notes in my own books. Which I used to just take notes on my phone. And now I'm like, what if my children and like I died in like 50 years, they're like, Mom couldn't
spell. Lady, but she doesn't spell.
They're going to be like, what does that say?
I think that'll just be endearing.
I hope so.
It says nothing.
I hope so. Yeah. It's a note. It's an acronym. Don't worry. So we're like so out of time. So I just have one more question for you, which is if you could have one person dead or alive, read this book, who would you want it to be?
Oh my God. You know, I mean, I have to say, is this a cop out? Like, I would be so interested in what Svetlana Boym had to say about this book, or like not even had to say. I think I would just be like so honored to know it like reached her hands. And unfortunately, she passed a few years back. And Masha Gessen wrote like a beautiful, just sort of, I don't know, ode to her. But I think I'd say like Svetlana Boym just because I would want to like say thank you. You know, this book is thanks in large part.
I love
you know,
that. It's not a cop out. Yeah. Every answer is allowed on this one.
Okay. Great.
People, you can get a map of future ruins now wherever you get your books. I will let you know that I read 80% of this book off the page, but I did listen to about 5 chapters via audio just to get a sense. It's not Lauren who reads them, but your audiobook narrator does a really good job. And I was like, I could believe this is Lauren. Like I felt she really nailed it. So for my audiobook people, stamp of approval. For my iReaders, stamp of approval. Get the book wherever you get your books. Lauren, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Tracy. This was such a joy. You were just such a brilliant reader and community advocate and person. And thank goodness for you.
You can come back anytime you want to give me compliments.
Great. And tea.
And tea.
Compliments and
everyone else, we will see you in the stacks. All right, y'all, that does it for us today. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you to Lauren Markham for being my guest. I'd also like to say thank you to Shailen Tavella for helping to make this conversation possible. Remember, the Stacks Book Club pick for February is Viral Justice, How We Grow the World We Want by Ruha Benjamin. We will be discussing that book on Wednesday, February 28th with Dr. Uche Blackstock. If you love The Stacks and you want inside access to it, head over to patreon.com/thestacks and join the Stacks Pack. Make sure you're subscribed to The Stacks wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, be sure to leave us a rating and a review. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram, Threads, and TikTok, at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter, and check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. Today's episode of The Stacks was edited by Christian Duenas with production assistance from Lauren Tyree. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tagirigis. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.